Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. We do have Bulldog Baseball coming up at 1:45, so the program will be a little shorter today, which means I better not waste any time. Let's get right to it with Jim Botkin of Dinuba, who is 87 years old but has some pretty crystal clear memories of his time aboard the USS Sterrett. And Jim, let's start before you ended up on the Sterrett. I don't know what's going on with my show lately. It seems like everybody I talked to grew up in Exeter, and that was your story, class of 1940 for the Monarchs. And let's start where I start with so many, as you know, asking about December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor Day. What do you remember about that day there in Exeter?
It was one of the few winter days that the sun was out, and so we were able to pick oranges that day, and I was working in an orange packing house as a receiver, and I heard the news on the radio during our lunch break. And the next day, saw pictures in the paper. And the day following that, I drove to Los Angeles. I don't know if you want details like this.
Absolutely. I think our listeners do. And for those who aren't familiar with where Exeter is, it's just along the western slope of the Sierra foothills in the San Joaquin Valley in Tulare County. So driving to Los Angeles in 1941 is a fairly long drive from Exeter.
Well, actually, I was maybe a little fast driver, but I went to the Naval Reserve recruiting place at in Chavez Ravine, which is now Dodger Stadium, and checked to see about enlisting. And they offered me, because I still was able to type, they offered me a second-class petty officer position in the Naval Reserve. But stupid me, I wanted to fight a war. I didn't want to sit somewhere and pound a typewriter, so I came back home and I went to the recruiting station in Visalia, and there I signed up for 6 years in the regular Navy as an apprentice seaman at $21 a month. And my training, my boot training, was very short, but I was selected, one of three people in my boot company selected for advanced training. I went to fire control school. I didn't want to, but they told me that's where I was going. And eventually, I wound up being assigned to the destroyer Sterrett. We served in the South Pacific, and I stayed aboard that ship through two surface battles and left her on the last day of December of 1943.
And so we're talking about 2 years from December 7th, 41 to the end of December 43, but those were two pretty eventful years for you. And I want to get back to something that you said matter-of-factly, because it's a part of your life and it's been in your memory for more than 65 years, close to 70 years now. But you said you wanted to fight a war, and this was just a couple days after the Pearl Harbor attack. Obviously, that meant something to you. There was a motivating factor there for you. What made you want to drive to Los Angeles and sign up and not wait for somebody else to get a hold of you?
I'm not sure I know, but I just had the feeling that it was time for me to do something. My dad was served during World War I on a U.S. submarine, and the Navy was, he had that experience, and that turned me in that direction, and I knew that we had to do something, especially after Monday when I saw the newspapers and the pictures of Pearl Harbor.
It sounds like that really registered with you on an emotional level, that there was that you felt your country was in great peril and that somebody needed to do something. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly right, yes.
So you told us where you went from there and how you ended up on the Sterrett, a destroyer. What were your duties on the ship, and what was like life on a World War II destroyer early on in the war in the Pacific?
Well, the destroyer, of course, is not a big ship. The ship weighed 1,500 tons. We had a crew of 190 personnel, and it very close living. The ship in the widest portions, only 35 feet wide, so you are confined. My job was in fire control, and for those of you not familiar with terminology, that's not a firefighter. Fire controlmen, their duty is to control the fire of the guns, and so from a high vantage point with telescopes and other equipment. You look at for targets, and you figure their course and their speed, and you use your own course and speed and run this all through your machinery, and thus you're able to aim your guns in a right direction where when a shell from our gun gets there, the target is at the same place. And so that's where the term fire control comes from. We control the fire of the guns.
And I imagine you hadn't done anything quite like that growing up in Exeter. I don't think they have a fire control class at Exeter High School.
No. And I really was not a hunter, so I wasn't used to, like the duck hunters and the dove hunters know with their shotgun to lead so that their pellets from their shotgun and the target get together at the same time. That's really what I had to learn how to do.
And you would have to learn how to do it in a hurry. I'm also curious, you talk about being at a high vantage point. How high above the deck are you? And is there anybody on the ship that's sitting any higher than you are?
No, we're the highest ones up there, and it's a very crowded little room-like that rotates. It has the telescopes, three telescopes that aim towards the target. One is the trainer who moves the unit in a horizontal plane. The one in the middle is the pointer, and he moves it in the elevation. And the one beside them is a leveler, and his job is a standby job to maintain the horizon. If for some reason you should lose the main gyroscope, it keeps your ships in balance. There is another one, which is my first battle station, is a cross leveler, and you keep your telescope on the horizon at a 90-degree angle from the others, and these two maintain the ship on a level plane, and you create a gun platform that is steady in itself, and the ship rocks underneath of it. And that is all part of the input that goes into a machine that we call a range keeper, and nowadays, in the modern days, is known as a computer. And we used mechanical equipment, gear trains, all kinds of types of cams and cam followers to solve these mathematical problems, and which nowadays are done with computer chips and so forth. And that equipment now in the modern ships is down in the bowels of the ship. We did it up at the very top where we could see everything, because most of our equipment in those days was set up for daylight fighting, and we had very, very basic radar that was just starting to be used, and not something we really depended upon.
I'm going to get to some of the intense moments of your battles, but I'm curious as you talk about this, and I know that you have followed closely the new wave of the Navy. In fact, the newest version of the Sterrett, and ship names live on and go through many iterations throughout history, and that you are familiar with what the ships are like today and what kind of technology that they get to use today. When you see a ship in 2010 and you think back to what your ship was like in 1942, are you blown away by how things have changed, or do you think they're, in a lot of ways, they're still very similar?
No, we're completely blown away. They're different. Their main purposes have changed. They're much bigger. For instance, my ship weighed 1,500 tons. The new destroyers weigh just under 10,000 tons. They are bigger, longer. They have a crew of 350 on up. And incidentally, as many as 85 of this crew are females. And that was something we thought about, but we didn't see on my ship.
If you guys woke up and there are 85 females on the ship, you would have thought it was a dream, right?
Yes, a very nice dream. But there is really, the modern-day destroyer is nearly as big as the light cruiser of World War II.
When you, and I know that you have interacted with some of the sailors who serve today, you ever get a chance to tell some of the people serving today about the conditions you guys were under and have their eyes really get wide and not believe what you were dealing with?
Yes, we have formed a reunion group consisting of former members and present members of Sterrett's There were four ships named Sterrett. The first one was a destroyer in World War One. That was the 27. And then the one I was on, the 407 in World War II. And then there came the Nam period with a larger one that started to have rockets. The newest one, which was launched in Bath, Maine in August of 2007 and was commissioned in Baltimore in 2008. This ship is now homeported in San Diego, and I've had the opportunity to tour it. And we've had reunion meetings where there are representatives of all four of the ships. And I have, on two occasions, been asked to reiterate the details of one particular battle that we were involved with in November of 1942.
Well, I think that's a perfect segue to talk about that battle right now for our listeners' benefit. And just as those sailors on today's Sterrett, I'm sure, were in rapt attention, we will be here. In 1942, your ship had a few battles to deal with. Tell me about your first taste of combat during World War II. Were you nervous at all? Were you ready to do that job in fire control up there on top of the ship? And what was going on in your mind? You're still a pretty young man here in 1942. You're what, 20 years old, if that?
19. Well, my first time we fired at an enemy was as an enemy reconnaissance plane, which was a float-type aircraft, which we knocked down. That was my first experience. And
here you told me that you don't have that duck hunting experience to lead the bird. You shot down a plane first time out?
Well, I was only one of a crew of people. There's about nine people up there in that little doghouse that are doing this, and there was much experience there far in advance of me. So I was just the tail end Charlie. But we have perfected over the years ways to target, and now the newest fire control systems can shoot and hit a target no bigger than a fly over the horizon. They cannot even see. They have so expanded and gone so far beyond what we were capable of doing. It's almost unbelievable.
That is hard to believe, and it's hard to imagine what must have been going on in your mind as a young man half a world away from where you grew up, out here in the Pacific, and watching and waiting for Japanese vessels to come your way. So the first time that you guys fired, that you remember, you hit an airplane, but pretty soon you'd be in a situation where it wasn't just reconnaissance planes, you had some ships that wanted to take you guys out. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, perhaps maybe the best way to start on that portion would start on Thursday, the 12th of November of 42. There were two task groups, one that originated in Espirito Santos and the other that originated in Noumea. And we met at Guadalcanal early in the morning of the 12th. And this combined force consisted of four transports, 12 destroyers, two heavy cruisers, one light cruiser, and two anti-aircraft cruisers. And the commanding officer was the Admiral Daniel Callahan, Admiral Callahan. And we, at daylight, the transports pulled in and dropped anchor and began offloading. About mid-morning, we were alerted to attacking air group, and the ships, they pulled up their anchor, and we formed a screen with our armored ships, the Navy ships, and we were attacked by 22 torpedo bombers that came in low in the water. They had come in and circled over Tulagi and then dropped down to water level and approached our unit. My ship at the time was in the point of the screen, and we knocked down two of the planes with 5-inch fire, and then we got two more with 20-millimeter fire, and we were credited with a probable on one more. All of these attacking aircraft were destroyed, and none of their torpedoes hit any of our targets.
What do you think the odds of that are? If going into a battle, you were told you have 22 torpedo bombers coming in, they're not going to get a single hit on you, and you're going to take them all out? That sounds like as big of a dream as 85 women on the ship.
Well, these things are kind of interesting when I look back at them, because really you don't do a lot of thinking. We've gone through much training, just continually training, and things become automatic. And when you get in a situation like this, you respond in that manner. This, I think, was not unusual for what we did. And the interesting part was that of all the ships that were involved that day, one destroyer, the Buchanan, was hit by a 5-inch friendly fire and it killed 5 of their crewmen. And one of the planes was disabled but managed to crash into the aft section of the cruiser San Francisco and damaged her secondary con and her after fire control tower and killed 30 of her personnel. But when we finished that, the transports went back and started their loading, offloading again. And then in mid-afternoon, we were again hit by a group, this time 30 aircraft. Most of them were two-engine bombers. They were codenamed Bettys, and they were very similar to our B-25s, and they were escorted by some Zero fighter planes. And aircraft from Henderson Field on Guadalcanal went up to meet them. And then as they came in closer, we opened up with our fire. And that day, we were attacked by a total of 52 aircraft, and we confirmed down 32 of those. And at the end of that, why, they went back and they continued their offloading. And when that was done at dark, why, we formed a screen around the transports and started escorting them in the direction of Espirito Santos on their way back to the States.
Well, you describe all this, and obviously you've been able to go back after the fact and look at the records, and the Navy kept great records. But I'm curious, and I think our listeners probably are, what was it like inside that fire control station? It seems to me that it must have been pretty chaotic. And how do you know who you're shooting at when there's all these ships around and all these planes in the sky? Seems like the crossfire aspect of it must have just been incredible.
Well, it is quite dangerous with the torpedo bombers because they're down on the water level. With the high flying, it's different. We don't have any. When they reach the range where we can shoot at them, then our planes are no longer involved, and so there's nothing up there but enemy aircraft.
Was this a situation that changed the way you felt about things or changed your comfort level? It seems like this would be pretty intense and something you had clearly never dealt with before.
No, it's something we trained for, and training in the Navy is just an ongoing thing. It never stops. And so you reach the point where you don't really think about what you're doing. It's what you do is automatic. And you've got a job that you're assigned to and you're trained to do it. And so you do it. That's it.
Simple as that. Well, maybe that's a good spot for us to take our first commercial break. When we come back, we'll get more about that sinking of that enemy battleship that Jim mentioned and hear about what he did the rest of his time on the USS Sterrett DD-407 during World War II. Jim Botkin of Dinuba, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Let's get right back to it with Jim Botkin, 87 years old of Dinuba. He was aboard the USS Sterrett, a destroyer during World War II. When we left off, you heard him talking about spending many of his waking hours on November 12th of 1942 in a heavy battle with Japanese forces. And this is one of those situations, Jim, sounds to me like November 12th of 1942 was a day that never wanted to end for the USS Sterrett.
Well, this is true. We left the area escorting the transports, which are now unloaded and headed back for home, until about 2000 hours. And at that point, the four transports and four destroyers were left to return by themselves, and the remaining 13 ships turned around and headed back to Guadalcanal. And we formed a battle line. We had received information that the approaching Japanese force was in two columns, and we formed a single column to go between them in opposite directions. And we engaged this force shortly after midnight on Friday the 13th. Our force that night was aligned with four destroyers leading. My ship was the third ship in line. This was followed by an anti-aircraft cruiser, then by two heavy cruisers, the light cruiser, another anti-aircraft cruiser, and then it was brought up by in the rear by four more destroyers. When we first made contact with radar with the approaching forces, it was about 20 miles away, and we could have reached them with enemy with our fire, but we did not receive permission to fire from the admiral. We actually were engaged and mixed together in their fleet before we reached the firing order. At that time, the lead ship, the Cushing, had picked up a target, and she had turned crossways to our line of approach to bring all her guns to bear, which caused the line behind her to have to veer off of the planned course. Our ship, we had picked up a target on the port beam, and we had laid our guns in torpedo tubes waiting the word to fire. But the word that came down first was even-numbered ships to port and odd-numbered ships to starboard. We had to swing around then and pick out a new target off the starboard, which we did immediately, which was a cruiser. And with the word from the admiral to commence firing, we launched a torpedo and opened up with our 5-inch 38s. We struck the pilot house and bridge of this ship, and the torpedo caused it to be dead in the water. And this ship was then finished off by some of our following ships. At that point in time, we became the target of a Japanese battleship, and the first salvo from her 14-inch guns damaged our mast. But at that point, we were only 6,000 yards away, so we closed to 4,000, and we launched four torpedoes. The two were confirmed hits, and one was a probable. And we also set many fires in her superstructure with our 5-inch fire.
And this is all happening in the dead of night. It's after midnight, the early morning hours. So I imagine this is quite the fireworks show that you're being treated to.
Well, yes, very much so. And the Japanese also used searchlights, which we did not. And we did fire some star shells to illuminate the area, but they used searchlights. As we cleared the battleship, a Japanese destroyer went across our bow, and we took this under fire, and we launched two torpedoes and fired open fire with our 5-inch, and this ship blew up and sank without firing a single shot in our direction. At that point, we were one of the few American ships left in the area, and as such, we became the target for remaining Japanese ships, and we took 11 hits from other ships, destroying our gun 3, gun 4, upper handling rooms 3 and 4, destroying our starboard torpedo mount, and other damage, some below the waterline, that went clear through the ship without exploding.
And I imagine from your vantage point up top in your fire control area that you're probably more aware of all this damage that the ship's taken than guys who are down on the deck. Is that fair to say?
Well, we're in a closed area, and you can look back. Yes, you can see the fires. You can't really, in the darkness, try to figure out what exactly is burning. But we saw that. Yeah. But we were still watching, moving around, and trying to spot any enemy ships that we needed to do something with. But at that point, because we were so heavily damaged and the fires were out of control, the captain opted to exit the area. And he rang up flank speed, the top speed we could make, and we left that area. However, this speed made it entirely or very difficult for the damage control people to fight the fires. But shortly thereafter, two of our boilers went down, and our speed was reduced to 24 knots, which made it much easier for the damage control people to put out the fires aft. Our gunnery officer, recognizing the damage or the potential damage of the fires and what it could do, had the two magazines astern flooded, which probably saved the ship. And from the first shot we received from the battleship, which hit our mast, that destroyed our search radar and our TBS system, which is the vocal system that ships use closely. It's very similar to the CBs that truck drivers use. So we had no communication whatsoever with any of the other ships of our unit. We didn't know if any other of our ships even got out until daylight. And at that time, we found that there were, in fact, six ships that had, out of the original 13, that had made it out. The San Francisco was badly damaged. The Helena, the light cruiser, had some damage. The Juno, one of the AA cruisers, was badly damaged. And we were badly damaged. The destroyer Fletcher had no damage, and the destroyer O'Bannon had minor damage. And with the damage to the San Francisco, the admiral and the commanding officer of the San Francisco were both killed. And so the commanding officer of the Helena was the senior officer present, and he took command of the retiring forces. And he lined the cruisers up in single column with the Fletcher running screen in the bow and the other two on the wings. And we headed back for Espiritu Santo.
It seems to me that I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes, and you told me you're not thinking much, you're just doing, because you're just following your training and it's the heat of battle. But when you finally realize it's over, at least for now, and you take stock of the damage to the ships and the damage to the whole group of ships that's there, what goes through your mind? Do you take a sigh of relief? Do you say, whoa, what am I in for here? What are we doing? What would go on in a sailor's mind in a situation like that?
Well, I there's a lot of shock that goes like this. When I first went aft at daylight and saw all the bodies of the people that were killed and were being prepared for burial at sea, you get kind of numb. And it's kind of a weird thing. I know that during the night when the guns were firing and so forth, I just knew I was going to die, and it didn't bother me. What bothered me was if it was going to hurt when I got it. It's really hard to explain, because you do. I think you're saved by a certain amount of numbness that comes over you, It takes a long time for you to really put all this back together about what happened that night, and actually continued that day, because about noon that day, a Japanese submarine penetrated our screen and torpedoed the cruiser Juno, and it evidently hit the magazines, because I was looking at her when the torpedo hit, and it was not a case of damage and then sinking. It was of one tremendous explosion, and when the smoke cleared, there was no trace of the ship. No trace at all. There had ever been anything there.
I can see how that would take your breath away and tell you, boy, if a torpedo ever hits us like that, then that is it for me and probably everybody else.
Well, that's very true. But again, there is a certain amount of numbness. And we made it back to Espiritu Santo, and we went alongside a tender, and they sent people over to do emergency patching on us, and they removed the ammo that we had in the areas where there had been heat and water, and prepared us to return to the States. And with that, we brought to San Francisco. We screened her back. We stopped in Pearl Harbor. We weren't really sure where we were going to be repaired. But I think the nicest thing I ever heard in my life was when Admiral Nimitz left the ship and told our captain, says, I'm sorry, Captain, I can't give you anything here but fuel. Enjoy your stay in the States. It was a beautiful thing to hear.
No one was complaining about that. But you would have more battles to come in your year and a half on the USS Sterrett. We've got a few minutes left in the show here. Why don't you take us to the next really significant events that you remember and what those events meant to you?
Well, the real next battle was August 7th of 1943, which coincidentally coincided with the landing date that we had done 1 year previous at Guadalcanal. And we had by then had taken the island of Munda. And it was being resupplied by the Japanese people. And our aim was to destroy that distribution line. And we worked out of a forward base for destroyers at Tulagi in Purvis Bay, which was right across the channel from Guadalcanal. And every late afternoon, six destroyers would leave there, and we would do what they called running the slot, and we would go through the narrow passageway around Munda towards Vela Gulf. And on that night, our group of six, we picked up the approaching Japanese force of four destroyers carrying troops and supplies for Munda. And Arleigh Burke, who is the admiral in charge of destroyers in the Pacific, had gotten earlier permission from Admiral Halsey to use destroyers as attack vessels instead of just primarily escort. And we had a battle plan set up, and when we made the contact, we set up the screens and separated into two groups of three. And one group went in and made a torpedo run from one direction, and then the other group came in from another direction and also did the same thing. And at that time, my ship picked up one of the Japanese destroyers that had not been hit, and we opened on fire with our 5-inch on it. And the end result was, of the four Japanese ships, we sank three of them. We disabled another one. It managed to make it back to Japan later, I learned, after the war. But it took it over a month to make it back. And our 12 ships, none of them received a single scratch. There was a special celebration in Washington, D.C. a year ago that I had the privilege of attending that recognized this new tactic and gave credit to Admiral Arleigh Burke, and further credit has now been extended to him by he being named as the class name for the latest model of the American destroyers.
How does that make you feel to know that you and all these guys you served with and got to know so well had a hand in something that at the time was really new, was a pioneering thing or a revolutionary idea in U.S. naval warfare?
Well, now I look back at it, and of course, I'm quite proud of it, that we were a part of that action. But all of this goes clear back to what we said earlier. We're looking at training, and so many of these things that you do out there maybe look heroic, but actually there's something we've all been trained to do, and we're responding to situations that we've been trained to meet. I wouldn't know how any other way to put it.
Well, and you talk about the incredible results of that battle in decimating the Japanese forces while your ships escaped, for the most part, unscathed. And it makes me think of something you told me about your graduating class at Exeter High School, that of the 27 men in that senior class of 1940, 23 ended up in the service. And how many of those 23 came home from World War II?
They all came home. We had some that were shot down in aircraft over Germany and were prisoners of war, but they all made it back home.
That's a pretty impressive track record. And you made it back home. You said a moment ago that in that battle at Guadalcanal in the middle of the night that you were sure you were going to get killed, you just didn't want it to hurt. I think there are a few people that are glad you didn't get killed. I'm for one to be here talking to you. But after the war, you met your wife. And how many other people are here that wouldn't be here if you hadn't come home?
Well, we've had 5 kids, and we've got 11 grandkids and 4 great-grandkids now.
That's 20 people, if I do the math right.
One other thing I would like to mention here, and I've never told, I don't think, anybody this but my wife, but on the way back from Guadalcanal, after we were damaged, and we stopped at Pearl Harbor, I happened to have the watch during the night out on the dock where we had a gangway over to the dock. And some nice soul there in Honolulu had donated a little radio. I can see it today. It was small, it was white, and it was plastic. And during that night, standing out there by myself, I heard Bing Crosby sing White Christmas for the first time in my life. And I bawled like a little baby. And I can tell you that today, when I hear Bing Crosby sing White Christmas, I still every once in a while comes a tear.
Well, I could certainly understand those sentiments, and I think probably a lot of people out there identifying you with you. Maybe some people had the same experience or something similar back then. Anything else that you think our audience needs to know? We're just about out of time, but when you think back to all the men that you served with and what you were in it for, what you were doing, What do you think we need to know today? What do we need to remember about what Americans in general, and especially you Navy guys, did during World War II?
Well, it's a bonding experience. Those of us, especially that were aboard the ship during that year, first year and a half of the Pacific War, are still close together today, those of us that still survive. And we have managed over the years to get together at a reunion somewhere in the country at least once every 2 years. One of my gunnery officer that night, who was a career Navy man, he's now 96 years old, and he made captain. I just had the pleasure of having some communication with him just last week. And so those of us that were together then are still together today.
Well, and that's a tribute to the kind of people that you are. I think everyone appreciates that. Jim, thanks so much for serving our country, and thank you for telling me a little bit about it. I wish we had more time for more of your stories, but thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
All right, Jim Botkin of Dinuba has been our guest today. If you'd like to see what he and his wife of 63 years, Juanita, look like, or see the ship he served on, or even the presidential unit citation the Sterrett received, go to our website, kmjnow.com, click on the Paul Leffler blog and the Hometown Heroes section to get a look at that. Bulldog Baseball coming up next. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.